Welcome to the All Souls Forum. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. In tonight's show, longtime local resident John Hoffman talks about the history of Kansas City, its neighborhoods and developments, past and present, from his personal perspective, and explains how he came to create Arts Arrive KC. Hoffman's organization hosts monthly events designed to help Kansas Cityans connect with the myriad of art offerings available in our metropolitan area. Our show was recorded on May 14th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Good morning. I'm George Baggett with the Forum Committee at All Souls Unitarian Church. You know, the forum was created for the discussion of controversial topics. However, today, the arts issues in Kansas City are not necessarily controversial. So I have the good fortune of meeting John Hoffman here through a group called the Arts Alive that he is the president of and founder. And he has essentially arranged monthly gatherings for people like myself that don't know anything about art. And we have visited art studios and venues around the city. And we went to the museum in Lawrence. So John is a well-known Kansas Cityan. He is a developer and art collector and has more to say about art than I ever would have. So without any further ado, I introduce you to John Hoffman.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's a beautiful spring day out there, and it's nice to be part of your community. George asked me to speak on a few different topics, but I think what I'll do is start on a little bit of my background so you can get acquainted with me personally and then some of the things that I've been involved in. Before I start, though, I want to ask a question. I'm going to talk a little bit about the arts. And I want to know, how many in the room have or are now members of the Friends of Art at the Nelson Gallery? Pretty good group of you. Well, that's impressive. When we get into what I'm going to mention today, we go to the Nelson Gallery every 3 or 4 years as part of Arts Alive. And I'm always curious. We have 100 people that come to our events every month. And I always ask the question, how many, when we go to the Nelson Gallery, how many of you are members? And only about 15 or 20 out of 100 raise their hand. And I think, wow, we really have a job to do in this community. But when you, I don't know if you've been reading about the Nelson, but in the last year, the attendance has grown from 350,000 annually to 550,000. Well, that's a tremendous accomplishment, and I give a lot of credit to the new director who's now been there 7 years, Julian Zugasagoitia, for opening the doors. And some people have criticized him a little bit for making it more of an entertainment venue. But I don't, you know, I see that maybe as a way to get people there, but once you're there, you have so much you can see. And I think the next step in their plan is to begin to offer some classes and some presentations in some of the galleries themselves by the docents. So you may get there on one premise of celebrating a Day of the Dead or Chinese New Year or what have you, but they're going to try, the next step will be to get you more engaged with the art. Anyway, I thought I'd give you a little background on my life in Kansas City. I grew up in Brookside and a long time ago. I'm 76, so I've seen a lot of the arts over the years. But I lived right near Southwest High School. I had an older younger brother and an older sister. Both of them went to Southwest, but my parents, I believe, thinking that I needed additional help, sent me to Pemdae. So I went there, and I got interested in the arts early on. Pembroke Hill, as it was called then, maybe even so today, was really interested in music, theater, dance, and even jazz. And we all had to play a musical instrument. And just a funny story that just came to my mind. So I took up the saxophone. And my instructor and the leader of the band was a South American by the name of Tutti Buttigoli. I found out later he also was the band leader for the burlesque. So I thought thought that the Folly Burlesque. I thought that was an interesting situation of teaching the boys at Pembroke Hill and then going down and playing the band. But that was a quick aside. Anyway, so I grew up in Brookside, and fortunately, I came from a very nice family. The old silver spoon, I grew up with that silver spoon. My grandfather was Isaac Katz, the founder of Katz Drugstores. And he had come to Kansas City in the early 1900s and opened his first store in 1916. I always remember that because it was the year my mother was born. So my grandfather was very involved in the community. And I don't know if you remember Katz Day at the Philharmonic. He'd give tickets out to anybody who wanted to go. Katz Night at the ballpark. But he was really about community. And he'd walk down the street downtown Kansas City. The Boley Building is where the offices were. At 12th and Walnut. And he had, my grandfather walked with a very pronounced limp. He had been hit by a baseball when he was a kid and had to have a special shoe and a special suit. But his suit coats had huge pockets. And on one side he had lipsticks and perfume for the ladies. And on the other side was Lifesavers and other candies for the guys. So a lot of people followed him around downtown. But of course, in those days, you know, downtown was the place to be. And an interesting story happened in the 30s. Walgreen and Rexall tried to come into Kansas City. And my grandfather had a fourth grade education. He had grown up in Austria-Hungary. Came to St. Paul because his brother was there and then used to sell sandwiches and newspapers on the train to Kansas City and started, as I said, Katz Drugstores. But he was a good marketer, and he knew that if Walgreen and Rexall came in, it was going to upset his, he had pretty much of a monopoly on pharmaceuticals in Kansas City. And Walter Cronkite, when he wrote his book about his life, used to say his dad would send him into Kansas City to go to Katz store to buy stuff that he could buy it cheaper at Katz than he could through the wholesaler. So that was the beginning of chain stores in this country. Was this Katz store, and he was a great marketer, and I learned a lot from him, and I. My father always said, don't ever go into this business. It's a tough, cutthroat business. So anyway, I graduated, and I went on to the University of Wisconsin. And then that was 1963 when I graduated, and you know what was happening. Well, two things. One, the Vietnam War was beginning to build up a little bit early with advisors, they were called. At the same time, John Kennedy had become president, and he came up with a program called the Peace Corps. Jay Rockefeller, Bobby Kennedy, and Sergeant Shriver came to the University of Wisconsin and spoke about the opportunities in the Peace Corps. Adage, ask not what country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And so a lot of us at Wisconsin and probably other campuses got very excited about that prospect of serving your country, and I went off to South America, and I was there for a couple of years setting up a national network of educational television, and then a year in Washington. Peace Corps is only 2 years. They don't want you to go down there and live a lifetime, just 2 years, and then get on with it. It was pretty hard to live down there. They gave us $150 a month for food and board. So we had to really be very industrious in figuring out where we were going to eat and live. But we made it, and a year on the staff of the Peace Corps, and then I got drafted. And people said, well, didn't you serve your country? And I said, well, I did, but some people didn't think I had served the country. So I wound up in the military. And the first day I was at Fort Dix, New Jersey, I think it was, and I was the only college graduate in my platoon. I thought, oh, gosh, this is going to be a long 2 years. So I asked the sergeant, is there anything I can do? You know, can I get to a platoon that has some people that aren't gambling away their per diems? I'll never forget that. And he says, well, why don't you take the OCS test and become an officer? And I did. I became an officer. And I'm going to, long story short, I wound up at Fort Riley, of all places. And, you know, from the East Coast, you know, I'm sure the officers and everything didn't even know where Fort Riley was. But you put a dream sheet, they give you a dream sheet of where you'd like to go. And then, of course, they never fulfill it. And I'm sure they looked at this thing and they said, this guy wants to go to Fort Riley, Kansas. We've never had anybody ask for that. So I wound up there and spent two glorious years at the post. I used to come in on the weekends and a 3-day pass, and I met my future wife here. She was a teacher at Shawnee Mission East in English and Latin. And so we've had a wonderful, almost 48 years together here, and we've lived mainly in this Midtown area, Crestwood, and then over on Onward Parkway, and then we raised our kids, and they went off to college, and I didn't think they'd ever come back. They're both very independent and very well educated, and they all have good jobs. But it turns out that our daughter and her husband came back here 5 years ago. So back to how I got involved in the arts. Just like you may have dragged your kids through museums and symphonies and all that. My parents would take me to the Philharmonic and over to the Nelson Gallery, and somehow or other I got involved in jazz. And I'll never forget, in 1956, I was 16 years old, and a friend of mine at school and I like jazz. We got really interested, and we would go down on Troost, 32nd and Troost, to the Golden Horseshoe, and we'd sneak in. We'd put on a coat and tie and sunglasses, and we'd go in, and we'd nurse a rum and coke for the evening and listen to Betty Miller and Milt Abel. And they were just so fabulous, and that was my beginning of my love for jazz. And my love for music in general. And so along the way, I got involved with the old Philharmonic. I became a vice president of the Philharmonic and watched it go down in 1979 for a year until Crosby Kemper came back and saved it. But so that was an interesting experience. And then in the early 70s, Sharon and I got real involved in visual art. And we began collecting contemporary art. And Ted Coe, who many of you may have known, he was the curator of art at the Nelson. In those days, there were basically two curators, one for Chinese and Asian art and the other for American art. And Ted took us under his wing and taught us how to collect art, which was very fortunate because today, you know, we just gifted a major work of art to the Nelson, and it's kind of become the centerpiece of their contemporary collection. And it's the third piece that we've given in the last 5 years. So we're very fortunate to be able to do that, and it's because of our love of the of visual arts in the Nelson Gallery that we've become supportive again by gifting some of our collection. But along the way, the other reason I was involved in visual arts is because my father was one of Thomas Hart Benton's closest personal friends. They had gone on a cruise together, sponsored by the Navy League, and gotten very, very friendly. And so my father was in some of the paintings that Tom Benton painted. And we had a few Bentons in our home. So I was fortunate enough to have an exposure early on to good art. And then Ted Coe came along in the 70s, and he said, do you all want to learn how to view art and be able to focus in on collecting art, if that's a passion or an interest of yours? And we decided we would do that. And today we have a beautifully collected, a major collection of contemporary art that started in 1970, and we still collect today. Along the way, I've been head of on the board of the Kansas City Art Institute, and I've been on the board of the Kansas City Repertory Theater, and we like all the arts, and we think the arts really add a dimension to your life that is very important as we go through our day-to-day, you know, jobs and raising families and all that. If you don't have the arts, you really are missing an ingredient that kind of fulfills, I think, a very important need of being able to enjoy the beauty of what art brings to us, both visually and performance-wise. In the late 90s, in 1999, I was involved in a lot of things. I mean, we founded the Kansas City Camerata, which was an orchestra in 1990. We played at the orchestra. I didn't have any, I don't play an instrument anymore, but the orchestra played at Unity Temple on the plaza. And we played for 8 years, and somebody said, well, why did we need another orchestra? Well, in 1990, when we put the orchestra together, the Camerata, we would ask people, when was the last time you were at the symphony? And a lot of people had dropped away from the early 80s to probably the late 90s. The orchestra was not very strong and didn't have very good leadership. Frankly, you know, they were attracting less than 800 people to a concert. So I don't know if you all remember those days, but some of the conductors we had were not too strong. And finally, Shirley Hillsburg came along and kind of got the orchestra turned around. And I saw that happening. And in 1998, I said to the board at the Camerata, I think it's time we kind of say goodbye and turn our support to the Kansas City Symphony. We would outdraw the symphony. We would have 1,000 people come to our concerts. And the critic for the Kansas City Star, they in those days they did have a music critic. yeah, Scott Cantrell, who was kind of controversial. But he would always give us nice reviews, and then he would slam the the symphony. And I kind of felt badly. But on the other hand, you know, it should have been a sign to them to get their act together, and they finally did. And that's the good news. Today, I think the arts are very, very strong and vibrant. So my daughter had come back from college in 1999, and she had a year before graduate school. And she said, Dad, I want to start a group of young people to get them more interested in the arts. And I said, well, that's great. So what's your plan? And she said, well, to have a monthly event, and we'll go to the concerts or go hear some jazz and just kind of get to know what's available in music and in visual arts in the city, go to some galleries and museums. And she was putting it together when she got the news that she was going to graduate school. And so she left. She said, this is a good idea. Why don't you take it over? And I said, okay, why not? You know, we had closed down the Camerata in 1998, so we had some time to maybe devote to something else. And we put a board together, and we kind of put the mission statement. And so the Arts Alive has been going 18 years or so, and we do an event every month except August. And we don't do anything in August because, as you know, it's very, well, most of the arts are kind of shut down to take a breather before the fall. And so there isn't, there aren't many offerings. And also, it's warm out there, and it's kind of hard to do the things that we like to do, which is sometimes be outdoors and go to public, go to private collections and just anything in the community that that we think would be valuable for our membership. And so in the 18 years, we have about 2,000 people that are signed up. I'll never forget, we decided we would do it without any paperwork. And so no invitations, nothing written, no stamps on envelopes. We were all volunteers. And we got a small grant from the Kansas City Association of Trusts and Foundations to get started. And we did hire a person part-time, but we realized we were running through that too fast because since we were not-for-profit, we kept the prices down. And we decided we would do it for $20 a month. So for $20, you were able to go to a visual event. So that could be an artist studio, a collection, somebody's home, a personal collection, a gallery or museum, etc. And then that would be accompanied by a reception. And then we'd go to a ticketed event, which would be music or theater or dance or what have you, jazz, for $20. Well, 18 years later, it's now $30, so we can see a little bit of inflation. Interestingly, though, this is the interesting point, is that our ticketed event is still $15. What's gone up is the food costs of the reception. I mean, you know, the $2 chuck is now $3. And so we try to do a nice reception. In fact, the other couple of months ago, we had an event, and we had the reception second after the first event. And I see a couple of ladies walking away from the second event, which was over at the KC Studios. And I said, "Why are you leaving?" She said, "Well, you ran out of food." And then I realized the food was the biggest part of their of their coming to the event. So I thought, "Oh, well, that's not right. You know, this is all about the arts. I mean, I need to tell people this reception is just small plates, and it's just to hold you over until you go have a meal somewhere." But some people love the fact that. What we do is we find caterers all over the city and give them an opportunity to showcase their food selections. So over the years, we've probably had 50 or 60 different caterers handle our events. But we've had a lot of fun doing it, and some experiences have been more interesting than others. But they always seem to, everybody seems to like them. For $30, you get, you know, the whole thing, and I guess it's the best bargain in town. If you'd like to, if you haven't gone to an Arts Alive event and you'd like to, it's easy to sign up. It's artsalivekc.org. And you just put your name on our website, and we send you an invitation about 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks ahead of the event. And if you want to go, you just sign up through PayPal. And it's that simple. There's no dues. There's no the membership is free. We have a board of about 12 of us that do all the work. As I said, in about the third year, we realized that even paying a part-time person to help us, we were going to run out of money because, you know, whatever we take in, we give to the artists and the musicians. But we've had some really classics. One time I said to the group, I think we ought to go to the Kansas City Women's Roller Derby. Right. So they said to me, well, what does that have to do with art? And I said, well, it's performance art. And they said, well, we're pretty skeptical about that, but okay, we'll go along with you. So it was only $15, and we got, you know, we sent the invitation in the email, and we had the largest turnout we've ever had. And people really liked it. So you just never know where you're going to find your best audience. But we've done the traditional things. You know, we don't go to the symphony and the ballet all the time because you can do that on your own. But we try to uncover under the surface the richness of the culture in Kansas City. And, you know, for instance, in theater, you know, the repertory theater, of course, is the best known. But under that, you have the Unicorn. You have the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater. You have the Musical Heritage. You have Kansas City Actors. We've gone to all of them, even down to the Living Room, which is a wonderful little storefront at 18th and McGee. That's developed, and it's a wonderful outlet for students coming out of the conservatory and UMKC having a place to perform. I think this city is blessed to have such great talent in theater. But in music, we have everything from the symphony to jazz to folk music. And to we did Bo Bledsoe, who's a classically trained guitarist, and we've been to his concerts. We've done tango. We've just run the gamut. It's amazing what you can discover if you really dig under the surface. So we've enjoyed what we've done. We sell out almost every month, and we'd encourage you to come and join and come to some of our events. I don't know how many of you take Kansas City Studio Magazine. It's free, and to subscribe, it's kcstudio.org/subscribe. But it really is a wonderful. I think it comes out every 2 months, and it tells you everything that's going on in the arts in Kansas City, and it's really quite a nice volume of information. I've had two careers. I started out, I was going to go in the Foreign Service. My background, my degree in college was Latin American Studies. And so the Peace Corps, and then I was going to go in the Foreign Service. Well, by the time I got through the military and was decided to get married, I thought, I don't know, I think I better get a real job. You know, my wife was a teacher at Shining Mission East, and she was, I remember when we got married, she was making $6,700 a year. And I said, I had always been interested in the stock market. And so I joined up with a firm called Dean Witter, which then became Morgan Stanley. And I had a 33-year career. And I retired in 2002. I just, you know, I had it was a very good career. I helped a lot of people with their investment advice and all. But it wasn't as fulfilling. I really wasn't putting back in the community like I really wanted to. So I, along the way in 1976, I helped found a group called the Historic Kansas City Foundation to save older buildings and older neighborhoods. And by 1980, they had made me president. So I'd always had a love for architecture, and especially historic structures. So when I retired from Morgan Stanley, I went right into rebuilding the urban core. And I've done, oh gosh, 8 or 10 projects. The most notable would be 16th and Summit over on the west side, overlooking downtown. I did 24 condos, and then I did a project over in Columbus Park, and then I moved to 30th and Gillam. Where, you know where the Greenlee's Cadillac building is? Well, right across the street. That neighborhood used to be the first area where you would go buy your automobile. And so by the year 2000, those dealerships had left the urban core for the Beltway. So I was able to buy up a lot of property over in there and restore some buildings and build some condominiums and some apartments. And so over the last 15 years, I've built a really nice apartment building at 29th and Gillam, 29th and Cherry, 37th and Gillam, which is Gillam Park Row right in Hyde Park, and then 63rd and Holmes. And people said, you're gonna build that close to Troost? And I said, yeah, I'm going to build that close to Troost, because I think Troost is ready to change. And so we moved our offices from 30th and Gillam. We also restored the filling station. I don't know if you've ever stopped in there for a coffee, but that was an old 1920 Standard Oil service station that had been closed since 1959. And we restored it and made it into a really nice filling station, coffee shop. And then everything else developed around it. And somebody said to me recently, you know, how did you know to do that? And I said, I had no clue. But I thought, you know, if I put a coffee shop in the middle of, which once was an interesting neighborhood, maybe things would happen around it. And sure enough, a lot of things have happened around it. Well, I did the same thing at 63rd. I feel that, it's time that the community start to look east, because the plaza is getting expensive. You know, it's just pushing people away because of, when national ownership comes in. You know, the Nichols Company treated it kind of like a pet project. But once they sold out, it's taken on a different atmosphere down there, I think. It's not quite the same as when Hartsfields and Swanson's and Wolf Brothers and all were there. And Halls is even gone. So you think about those things when you begin to develop neighborhoods. But what we've done is we've gone in, we moved our offices over to Troost, 43rd and Troost, and we've begun to develop Longfellow neighborhood, which was the first neighborhood outside of downtown. And it's between Gillam and Troost, and about 24th Street to 31st. And so we built six houses there. I'll never forget, we built our first house. Well, we built two. And I said, I'm going to take a risk and build two houses and see if they sell. Because no house had sold in the last 30 years for over $120,000 in Longfellow. And we built these two houses, and they each sold for $250,000. Well, the neighbors were aghast. How could this guy come in there and build these houses and get double the price of any other house? And so they all asked me, well, and I said, you know, there hasn't been a new house. So, you know, some people will come into an older neighborhood, but they don't necessarily want to inherit a house that's 100 years old with all the issues that an old house may bring. So then we tried two more, and they sold, and two more. So we did six houses, and then we did some some townhouses. And then we jumped over Troost and started developing Beacon Hill, which there wasn't much left of Beacon Hill. They had pretty much scraped it from 24th to 27th, Troost to Paseo. But I thought, you know, it's so close to the health department and Truman Medical and Children's Mercy that maybe some doctors or nurses or staff might want to live closer than Blue Springs. Which, of course, you know, in the, you remember what happened in 1954 in the Supreme Court? Brown versus Topeka Board of Education. Well, the unintended consequences were everybody, you know, white flight to the suburbs. It was also exacerbated by the fact that Eisenhower created this beautiful federal highway system to go around all these old neighborhoods that it was easier to get around than to go through them. Well, so we know what's happened. In the 60s, there were 80,000 children in the Kansas City, Missouri school system. Today, they're under 16,000. So that's an 80% drop, school-aged children, and they're all in the suburbs. But they are beginning to come back. Young people don't see the issues of that Troost created. And a lot of charter schools have come in. And so a lot of rebirth is coming to these older neighborhoods. So we've been building houses. We've been building apartment buildings. And in this last November, we started a third phase in our company. We are rebuilding some of the beautiful older homes east of Troost. And since November, we've purchased 28 of them. The prices we pay for these houses, I mean, it's astounding what's happened. But, you know, some of the houses just fell into disrepair and were in really bad shape. But other houses, you drive through some of these neighborhoods, they're still beautiful. And they're still beautiful architecture. So we've paid between $200 and $30,000 for these houses. And we spend between $40,000 and $100,000 restoring them. And then we put them back on the market. And we sell every house that we have restored. The Mannheim neighborhood is where we've been concentrating. Mannheim is just east of Troost between 39th and 47th, not too far from here. And we just finished our second house there. And it was a teardown. The city had it condemned. And they wanted to tear it down. And I said, no, this house is too beautiful. And it's worth saving. So we saved it. We paid $7,000 for it. And it just sold for $168,000. So it just shows you that young people today don't see the issue of Troost. That same house just west of there in Hyde Park would probably have been $250,000. Anyway, that's kind of my history, my background. Oh, gosh. George, we hit it right on the button for questions. So anyway, I encourage you all to get more involved with us at Arts Alive, and I'll be happy to answer some questions when the time comes.
I'd ask you all to ask questions and not make statements. However, after the forum, we'll be able to go to the library and or the meeting room, one of the two, or wherever we're going to go today, and you can make your statements at that point. But I'll let John take questions while we take the collection. Thank you.
When my mother went to high school at New Trier, on Chicago's North Shore, they had art appreciation classes at the high school level. Do we do that here in the metropolitan area? And if we're not doing it, why don't we?
Well, I wish we could say every school in greater Kansas City was like New Trier. That's where my wife went, got her teaching certificate through Northwestern and school taught at New Trier. But, well, you know, when school districts have to cut expenses, one of the first areas they cut are the arts. So I don't think the arts are as strong today as they were. We have Young Audiences, which is a not-for-profit that has been in Kansas City since the 60s and does a great job. There are a lot of programs that have been started on the grassroots level, a lot of dance programs especially, but theater also. And so those are the feeders that come into the conservatory and UMKC and KU and other schools in the area. And so I think the arts maybe aren't as strongly supported by the elementary and high school programs, but their creative parents have found ways to get their children into cultural programs.
Good morning. I really appreciate the range of your talk, from J.C. Nichols to Longfellow and Mannheim in 2017, and 63rd Street, where close to where I live. So I want to ask a question that I believe you have a rather particular and unique perspective on, and so it's not intended to put you personally on the spot. But a couple weeks ago, we got a report, or there was a report generated out of the Urban Institute that indicated that the Kansas City region is the fifth most segregated large metropolitan area in the country, and that since 1990, we've been moving up the list towards the top of more segregated. So I'm interested in your thoughts about your work in rebuilding the neighborhoods in the blighted urban core, and the extent to which Arts Alive is a multicultural, genuinely, those 2,000 people, for example. Is there a challenge there that you are effectively overcoming, or is it an uphill battle? In fact, does it kind of look like a perpetuation of the restricted covenants that came before the expressways and had a lot to do with, you know, how we ended up with the way we are? So your thoughts on, is Arts Alive making us less segregated, or is that something that needs some help?
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll take that one first, that part of it, Arts Alive. Our board is the 12 board members, 4 are African American. And we have, out of our membership, I would say at any given event where we have 100 people, only about 10% are African American. But it's open to anybody. And, of course, we do a lot of things with Alvin Ailey, Kansas City Friends of Alvin Ailey. I forgot to mention, my wife and I were one of the founders of that group 32 years ago. And we always feature Ailey dancers every year. So we do Ailey, we do jazz, a lot of jazz. And we don't see the discrimination in our programming or in our attendance. It's just a matter of trying to find a more diverse crowd. And we, because of Arts Alive and some of our interest in diversity, we've worked with groups like the Kansas City Art Institute and the Nelson Gallery to open their doors to a wider variety of folks in the community. And I think it's working. Business-wise, we made a concerted effort to go east of Troost with all of our developments, mainly because that's the area that's underserved. There are a lot of developers downtown. You see cranes all over the place, and in Westport and in Crossroads. But there aren't very many developers. In fact, I can count them on one hand or three fingers. That are working on Troost or east of Troost. And so it's a personal preference for us. Our buyers of our homes are mixed. A lot of young people are coming back, and they don't seem to feel that there is a distinction between east or west of Troost, which is a good thing. Our renters in our apartments I would say because we're on Gillum Road and at 63rd and Holmes in Brookside, our diversity is about normal, probably 15 to 20% African-American. I hope I answered that. Okay.
How about Hispanics in your program?
Well, that's a good question. We try to do things in the Hispanic neighborhoods when we can find. They're not a very homogeneous group observation, except in the home in their homes. They're very much about the family and about their heritage. As far as being involved in the arts, I don't see it too much. We do some folk music and have tried to incorporate Hispanic music. Bo Bledsoe does a lot of work in that field. And in our building, that's a different story. We have 45 people that work for us in rebuilding the older homes, and I would say 70% of them are Hispanic. They work for us. Interestingly, the day after the president came down real hard on immigration, we lost four of our workers. They had been in Kansas City for over 5 years, but they weren't citizens, and they felt threatened, and so they left. And then 10 days later, we lost 10 more. So I said to my partner, what are we going to do? And he said, well, Mr. Hoffman, we have so many people that want to work for us. We'll fill in right away. These were good workers, and it's so sad to see them threatened living in a democracy to fear for their lives and their families.
Going back to your discussions relating to the Nelsons' mm-hmm. tremendous increase in attendance and participation, during that time, in your view, from what you know, do you feel that there have been more minorities who have been participating in programs and attending there than previous to that time?
Well, I don't want to get into too many controversial issues here, but I kind of felt that the Nelson had become rather elitist. And in fact, I don't know if they even cared if people came through the door, you know, no matter what their nationality or race or religion or ethnicity. But starting in 7 years ago, I began to see a major shift in policy over there. And the guards became more friendly. and the doors opened wide. And they began to celebrate different nationalities and different groups. And this June, they're doing Juneteenth, which is the first time ever. Juneteenth, it's called. It's a celebration of in the African-American community. So I see a major change, and it's very healthy. And the gift we made to the Nelson, which was a Kehinde Wiley major 9-foot painting, I don't know if any of you have seen it yet, but it's a football player. I mean, he has a jersey on and a baseball cap and tennis shoes. And one of the things that I remember about in the Obama administration, Michelle Obama saying, you know, when she was a child, she would go into a museum and she never saw any paintings of anything that looked like her family or her neighborhood. And so things are beginning to change. And the Nelson's very open to it, and they've acquired a number of paintings by prominent African-American artists. So I think that's a positive.
Question about in your business development, transportation and transit in particular, and the changing, you know, attachment of those young people to personal vehicles. And you just mentioned you don't want to get any controversial, but I have to bring up the notion of the streetcar and what I see as a, almost a nullification of the work that's been going on Troost for the last 20 years. And so just looking at it from your development perspective, what do you need from the Area Transportation Authority, and are you able to at least get the conversations you need, or is that something you have to work around?
Well, that would be Department of Transportation, basically, and the KCATA. And, you know, I think the streetcar was a great idea. It's more of a, what should we say, kind of gimmicky, because it doesn't go anywhere. You know, 2.2 miles from the River Market to Union Station. But what it has created is literally millions of dollars of development along that street of restaurants and bars and apartments. So I think it's doing a positive effect on that area, and that's a good thing. I think the ATA has been very aware of transportation issues, and the Troost MAX line is the most populated bus route in the city. So I think that's going to be a positive for us developing along Troost. Our next project is a 50-unit apartment building at 55th and Troost, just south of Rockhurst and UMKC. And it'll be the first apartment building built on Troost in over 40 years. And it's going to be a micro apartment building. I don't know if anybody read the paper about that, but micro units are small, and they're very popular all throughout Europe and Southeast Asia, and on the east and west coast of the United States. They're as small as 300 square feet. But they're affordable, and they come with all the furniture built in except for a mattress. So a young person, a junior, senior in college, or a graduate student, or a young professional just coming out, can move in with no furniture needs. And, you know, today, I remember my parents lived in the same house for a long, long time. My father had the same job. My grandparents the same way. But today, young people move around quite a bit. They're very transient. And the last thing they want is a bunch of furniture to transport from place to place. And a lot of them are not using automobiles like we used to or we thought we had to have. They're using bicycles or walking or taking public transportation. So they've found ways of keeping their budgets in line and not having to worry about an expensive car and insurance and energy costs. I think, what do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention. So young people today are figuring out ways of handling whatever their income is. I do see an awful lot of them in bars and restaurants, however, and maybe they should be at concerts more.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank you. wasn't that wonderful? We have an honorarium of the cup that you've officially spoken at the Unitarian Forum.
Great,
and
thank
you
very
so much. John's agreed to stay with us in the library for a few minutes until people get questions or statements made. And next week's program is my speaking next week on dystopian issues. And we'll look forward to seeing some of you next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Arts Arrive, KC, with John Hoffman. This program was recorded on Sunday, May 7th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.